The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Inflation rates are soaring to the highest rate in over four decades. Instead of going down, inflation is rising higher from food to gasoline. Americans are facing double-digit inflation. From the Biden administration's spending programs, a loose monetary policy by the Fed, supply chain issues from the pandemic, to the war in Ukraine, all contributing, sending inflation to levels we have not seen since the 1970s. And it's not just goods inflation, service inflation is soaring. This is going to force the Fed to get more aggressive on rate hikes. Today's consumer confidence numbers have also fallen to the lowest levels on record. Unemployment claims are rising as layoffs begin or companies are initiating hiring freezes. The combination of Fed tightening and rising oil prices is now raising the possibility of a recession. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. John Roque joins me at the top of the hour. John sees more damage ahead for the financial markets, higher inflation ahead, and a more aggressive Fed. Later on in the program, Mike McClone from Bloomberg Commodities discusses why he believes gold and oil are heading higher. And finally, Chris Poplava and I will discuss the perfect financial storm that lies directly ahead of us that will be released in a two-part series beginning today. Part two will be discussed and aired next week. But first, let's find out what's moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava, including today's big jump in the inflation rate.
Investors got a black eye because of the CPI this week. Inflation was the hottest topic from Monday all through Friday. Multiple central banks raised rates this week, including the Bank of Australia, India, or in the case of the ECB, they intimated they plan too soon. It was warned by the White House that CPI would be hot, and hot it was. CPI increased 1% in May over April, up from 0.3% in April. The idea that inflation may have peaked has been shoved off the table. Core CPI, which is without food and energy, was up 0.6%, the same as the previous month. On a year-over-year basis, the consumer price index was up 8.6% versus 8.3% in April, and core was up 6% versus 6.2% in April. The food index saw its largest 12-month increase of 10.1% since March of 1981, and energy prices continue to debunk the idea that inflation has peaked. The consensus now is that the Fed is likely to stay aggressive at this rate, likely past Jackson Hole and into September, where some have suggested they could pause. The Fed wants to pause eventually towards the end of this year based on the Federal Open Market Committee's notes we got last week, but at this rate, inflation might not allow that until we have enough demand destruction, potentially taking us into recession. Originally, the week started with a ray of hope regarding inflation with the Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo saying removing tariffs on some goods could bring down inflation, with news that Biden is considering this according to Bloomberg. Treasury Secretary Yellen echoed these comments on Wednesday as well. Additionally, there was news in the Wall Street Journal that the U.S. will pause solar tariffs for 2 years. And additional good news came from Elon Musk, who clarified from last week total headcount at Tesla will increase this year, though salaried staff will remain flat. Another news item that is not helping the inflation front is reports China is loosening COVID restrictions in its largest cities and that it too is considering relief from tariff and regulatory matters, like the conclusion of its cybersecurity probe into DiDi Global, which is known as the Uber of China. On the plus side for inflation, Thursday there were new reports of China building facilities for permanent zero coronavirus policies, in addition to news in another district in Shanghai, was being shut down, according to the Financial Times. There was also news that Saudi Arabia would increase prices in Asia due to stronger demand there. Central bank news this week hit interest rates and inflation sentiment hard. The Bank of Australia raised its key lending rates 50 basis points to 0.85% when it was expecting to only raise by 25 basis points. The Bank of India raised rates 50 basis points as well to 4.9%, which was higher than what it was expected. Finally, the European Central Bank announced its plans on Thursday to raise rates next month by 25 basis points to start, and that it would also end its net asset purchases as of July 1st, meaning they're beginning their taper. There were some key comments from companies this week that also covered the risk assets in a cloud. Target gave profit margin warnings on Tuesday, blaming excess inventory that they needed to clear. Union Pacific did the same, blaming cost inflation on their falling profit margin. Intel Wednesday said the macro environment has been weaker and circumstances are worse than expected coming into the quarter. These stories from companies seem to give credence to some of the macro talk as well. The latest Atlanta Fed GDP Now forecast is estimating GDP is running at 0.9% as of June 8th, where it has been descending since early May when it had peaked around 2.5% for the second quarter. Another growth announcement came from the OECD, which has cut its GDP estimates for global GDP down to 3% from 4.5%. Stocks appear to be ending the week down considerably on these growth concerns, inflation data, and the hawkish steps by major central banks this week. The S&P 500, NASDAQ, and Russell Small Cap Index are all on track to lose between 4 and 5%, which appear to be resuming the year's downward trend and erasing the hope rally post the Fed minutes just a couple of weeks ago. Oil, interest rates, and the dollar all remain elevated, and the volatility index has started to move up higher again. Unfortunately, ending the week on a sour note for the bulls. That wraps up the week. Up next, John Roque, this week's guest market technician.
The story is that people are afraid of an invasion of Taiwan, but what they're planning is to blockade Taiwan. They want negotiations. They want to envelop Taiwan and say, look, you engaged in a relationship with China on the One China policy, and now you're helping the Republic of China, Taiwan, with armaments, with training their military. You have violated the basis of our relationship. We need to renegotiate that relationship, and we need to bring that 23rd province into our country and put an end to this nonsense. That is going to be China's negotiating position.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market seems to be meandering, one day up, one day down. Where are we heading forward from here? Will we get into a recession? Will the bear market continue? Will the bounce continue? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is John Roque. And John, you sent me a couple charts, and I'd like to start out with them. What are they telling you? The first one was about the transports. And what is that telling you with the transports? Because that plays an important role in the economy.
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me. Great to be with you again. I was looking at the transports on a longer term basis, and it just seemed to me, based on the index's own history, that it was not likely that this is a good time to be doing any buying, number one. And number two is it's probably more likely that the index goes lower first before such an opportunity presents itself. And you could see, at least based on the chart's history, that we're pretty far from being oversold. In fact, if you go to Robert Shiller's website, you could download it right in Excel. Dr. Shiller is kind enough to provide the data. It's remarkable to me how more people in our business don't use Shiller's cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio. Its acronym is CAPE. If you download all the data, and it goes back to 1881, and you graph it, you'll find that the long-term average PE is about, you know, let's call it 17 or so. There have been five prior cycles where the PE has peaked above that average level. The first time was in the late 1800s of 1901, actually. It peaked at 25. The PE declined 81%. The Dow dropped 45%. I'm using the Dow because I have historical data for the Dow back that far. The second time it peaked was, of course, in the 29 peak. It peaked to 29. The PE declined 83%. The Dow declined 89%. The third cycle saw the PE peak was probably around 1935 or 36, and it was at 22. The PE declined 61%. The Dow went down 52%. The fourth cycle saw the PE peak in 1965, right around 24. The PE declined 65%. The Dow declined 40%. The most famous of these occurred into the tech peak when the PE was almost 44. The PE declined 70%. The Dow went down 37%. Now, in these five instances, every time you got a PE peak and turn lower above the average, you always went below the average. The only time it did not happen was in 2018 into the COVID low because the Fed forestalled it to continue. But the peak in 2018 was 33. This time, Jim, the peak was 39.
Wow.
If you take the long-term average PE decline and you take the estimated Dow decline, the PE would decline from 39 to 12 for about a 70% decline, and the Dow would go down 45% from its peak, which would get it to about 20,000. That's not a forecast, and I'm not being hyperbolic. I just think perhaps your listeners might want to download this data and take a look at it themselves, because I think it's quite instructive that once you peak after being expensive based on this CAPE, and it is a long-term 10-year cyclically adjusted price-to-earnings ratio, you really don't stop on the PE going down until it gets below the long-term average. And so I don't know how long that will take, but if history is any guide, we should not dismiss Dr. Shiller's cyclically adjusted PE ratio.
Well, that brings me to your second chart. Let's begin with oil. John, on the West Coast, we've got gasoline prices in LA over $8, diesel over $9. And it's become probably the number one issue in the country right now because it affects everything. What's your take on oil? Where do we go from here?
Going back over the history of Brent's trading life, we find that when Brent goes up at least 100% year on year, the U.S. goes into a recession. So it went up 100%, greater than 100% on a year-over-year basis when it came off of what was the 2020 low. But it is still up right now. It's almost 70% year on year. So oil prices, I think, will continue to bite. And if history is giving us a good signal here or a good lesson, we should think about perhaps some recessionary effects going forward.
I want to go to another chart you have here, which is uranium, which we're very bullish on and own. And that is, John, if you take a look at this movement to go to a green economy. So at night, you and I are going to have electric vehicles in our car charging at night, not to mention all the other things that we have electronically that have to be charged. Where are we going to get this energy from to power all this electricity? And it seems to me nuclear power is a natural solution. So what is uranium prices telling you?
So, Jim, you and I are in agreement here. However, I'm going to use a quotation from Winston Churchill, which he uttered during World War II. He said, "The U.S. always does the right thing, but only after it's exhausted every other option." So I figure we'll eventually get to uranium because it is the cleanest fuel. But I think we're going to have to go through some difficult periods because the people who are promoting alternative energy in the administration don't want to go with this. They would rather go with solar and wind. And so I think it'll only be a matter of time, but it might likely be a longer time. And it seems to me a little bit short-sighted that we've come this far on the ESG mandate, but didn't understand what the unintended consequences of such a mandate were. In order to get electricity, you have to burn coal. Batteries don't make electricity. They just store electricity. So I don't want to say this because I'm rooting for it, but I figure we're going to be up for some more pain going forward before we come to the realization that uranium is the cleanest and likely cheapest option.
I want to talk about some of the big FANG stocks. What's your take now? Because those FANG stocks were big drivers of the S&P, especially given their market weight. What is your take on the FANG stocks now? I mean, if you look at Amazon, if you look at Apple, I mean, Apple's down, but it seems to be holding up better than some of the others. What's your take here?
I think that for the most part, tech as a whole has been put through the ringer. But I think the most important stocks, to a great degree, are still holding up fairly well. You mentioned Apple. I think Apple is going to have more trouble here, and I think it has risk to 100. I know that may not sit well with a lot of folks out there, but that's the way I think about it. My first target for Amazon pre-split was $1,000, so it got there. Split 10 for one, of course, and I think it's going to come down again. So it rallied from 100 to about 130, and I think we'll see at least a retest of 100 for Amazon. And then if we can move on to Google, I mean, Google has had a big rally here. My target on the downside had been 2,000. So it got to 2,000. It's rallied now to 2,400. But into resistance, I think it'll come back down again. Facebook, of course, has been the worst performer of them all. And I still think that goes lower. I still think that the excesses in the market are still within these FANG or Big Seven stocks, Microsoft included. And then, of course, Tesla. And if we wanted to add another one, we could add Nvidia. But I still think, Jim, that this is where the excesses lie. And I believe these stocks will come lower again. And until people kind of, you know, give up on them, and that's too strong a phrase here, but until they stop looking at them as saviors, perhaps we'll be closer to a good low than we are now.
I want to come back to energy for a moment. So if you expect the possibility that oil prices are going to head higher, let's talk about some of the energy stocks. It's hard to believe, John, less than 2 years ago, Exxon was selling at $32 a share. Today, it's hitting probably an eight-year high with Exxon over $100.
I think it's an all-time high.
So if you were an investor looking at where these stocks have gone, I don't care if you're looking at Chevron, Exxon, maybe Royal Dutch and BP less so because of issues with Russia, would you be buying energy stocks here?
So I'm going to say to you that I think these stocks have done an awful lot of work this year, number one. Number two is Exxon, for example, has gone from 60 to a new all-time high. And, you know, it's overbought and extended vis-a-vis its moving averages. Number three is if we're going to have another leg down in the market, as I believe we will, then it would not surprise me if even the leaders, and in this regard, it would be energy, come under pressure. So I would look to buy them on such a pullback that is within the construct or the confines of a general market pullback. I believe if that occurs, then they should be the relative strength leaders coming out of such a pullback. I do not believe it will be tech. I think people will go back to tech, but I think that will be a failing trade. And while they're up a lot in price, the market cap weight of energy in the S&P 500 has only gotten back to 5%. That only just happened where it got back to 5%. Please remember that its all-time low in market cap was about 2%, you know, a few years ago. And then it started to rally. And I had written back then that I said, how many of us out there believe that energy could get back to 5%? What was the breakdown level? So it was 2% in October of 2020. And in March of 2021, when it was about 2.25%, I said, how many of us out there really believe that it could get back to 5%? And it got back to 5%. The average weighting for energy in the S&P 500 from September of 1989 to date is about 8.5%. And so it now is 5% of the S&P. So I think the way to think about energy is to compare it on a relative basis to tech. And while energy's up a lot, relative to technology's performance, I still think it has further to go. So on pullbacks, I would prefer to buy energy. And on rallies, I would prefer to sell tech.
I'm going to talk macro for just a minute and then talk about what comes out of this, because I'm in agreement with you on a possible recession. Every recession, at least in my career, John, has been preceded by interest rate hikes and spikes in oil. And that's certainly what we're seeing now. We've seen, you know, the 10-year Treasury note go from under 0.5% all the way now almost to 3%. And then we've seen oil prices, you know, almost double here. So if you look at this, when we go through bear markets and we go through recessions, we come out of it, usually sometimes there's a change in leadership. And I want to talk about the commodity sector, John, going forward, because I see this as a very strong decade for commodities, whether we're needing copper for the green economy, building homes, whether we're going to need more oil to run the economy. Copper, oil, iron ore, nickel, all those kind of things. What's your take on commodities in this cycle that we're in now?
So I've thought that we're in a commodity bull cycle. Commodity bull cycles last about 15 years. This one, I think, according to the way I measured it, started at the end of 2020. And I would say that it probably wasn't until this year that people really started to pay attention. Now, I don't do deep commodity work, so I'm only going to tell you what I've read. I've read that there's a situation here which really hasn't occurred in our lifetime, where most commodities are in lack of supply or a deficit, and they're all trading in backwardation. So I don't know how long it takes for commodities to go from deficit to surplus, but it would seem to me that these things don't happen in a very short term time frame. So I want to believe that the commodity cycle can likely continue. If you look at the commodity spot index relative to NASDAQ or the S&P or the Dow or the Russell 2000, you've had big turns in relative performance for commodities relative to those other indexes. And as I said, these commodity bull markets tend to last about 15 years. It is odd to me, I will tell you. It is odd, however, that we don't have participation from gold nor silver. It is odd to me that some of the industrial metals don't perform as well as I thought they would have, like copper. So far, this commodity cycle seems to be driven by energy, which I'm sure most people would agree with, and ag. But metals, they're certainly making me look over my shoulder with respect to the length of any commodity cycle.
That was going to be my next question, because we've seen energy, you know, we've gone from, it was hard to believe we actually had a negative print in oil in 2020, but we've seen the price of energy skyrocket. We've seen copper prices. We've seen natural gas go up. What is surprising, gold hasn't done much of anything. It's been trading in between 1800 and 1900. We had a brief spike up to 2000. Why do you think that is?
Jim, I'm going to give you the worst answer you possibly expected. I'm going to say, I don't know.
I appreciate your honesty.
No, I just don't know. It may sound foolish, but I think it's probably better than making something up. And I'll tell you, just to lay myself at the feet of the scales of justice here. In the beginning of this year, I was really encouraged by the setup for gold. And I thought that gold would have a push and make a new all-time high. And it was kind of a Pyrrhic victory because it made a minor new all-time high above where it was in the summer of 2020. And then it came in very sharply. So A, I was unprepared for that. B, I don't know what ails gold. It may be the most talked about item that I can think of that has the least amount of return associated with it. So perhaps that isn't, that's a curious juxtaposition. People talk about it. They want to know about it, but it doesn't do anything to get you paid. So I'm going to say, I don't know what is bothering gold. I can, certainly surmise, but I don't think any of my guesses is going to be any better than anybody else's guess.
So as we conclude here, John, given the state of the markets where they stand today, as an investor, what would you be doing?
I'd be waiting. And we've often heard that cash is trash. I don't think it's trash at all. And I want to ask a question, and it's going to be rhetorical. But I've heard over the last few weeks that stocks are now cheaper than they were, and we should be paying attention to multiples here. And so I'm going to, I went to school in the Bronx. I'm from Mount Vernon, so I'm going to be a little bit of a wise guy. Why should we be paying attention to multiples now when we certainly didn't have to pay attention to them on the way up? Why were multiples allowed to get to such extreme levels on the way up? But now on the way down, we should be monitoring them now because they are, in quotes, cheaper than they were. My point of saying this is, if multiples didn't matter on the way up, why will they matter on the way down? And so, you know, that's rhetorical. It's a diatribe. It's one that I'm going to stick to here because I think that there's a curious juxtaposition that people want to justify multiples now when short-term rates are roofing, when oil's up a lot, and when profit margins are likely peaking. And I think when you have an environment like that and high inflation rates, and if you go back to the 50s and you have high inflation rates of this magnitude on the PPI and the CPI, you know, it's more than likely, it's nearly always the case that there is a recession to come. So I think it's probably likely that it's a better idea, not probably likely, I think it's a better idea that investors be patient here. I think they're going to buy, for the most part, stocks at lower levels. I just don't think it's here now. I think it's still to come.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And even with PE multiples coming down, what hasn't been factored in yet, and especially with the scenario likely for a recession, is earnings could miss and come down. And if earnings come down, you could see rising PE ratios based on price if nothing else changes. So I would agree with you 100%. So your view overall is, hey, maybe sit on the sidelines and just watch this thing unfold because, John, I don't see how rising rates in oil prices, we've never seen them this high. Well, listen, John, as we close, how can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I'm associated with a firm, 22V Research. It's an institutional firm. It started in October of 2021 and then really in full force in January of 2022. And, you know, we send out our notes and research to institutional clients, but certainly they can take a look at our website. And if they're RIAs or those type of clients, they can certainly contact us, but at least they can get a flavor for what we're talking about by just looking at the website. So thank you for asking.
All right, John. Well, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have a great rest of the summer.
You too, Jim. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Oil is $122. Today, gasoline is $5 a gallon. You know, how high can that go? Well, it'll go until we have demand destruction, until prices get so high that new production either comes online or we have demand destruction. And I don't see the likelihood of new production coming online anytime soon. Even with all this, there's really no investment being made in oil companies. You know, we're not seeing major new CapEx spending programs. And so if you look at what oil price is needed to impact and impair demand, it's probably, you know, $150, $160 oil. At that point, total energy consumption as a percent of the economy is about 10%. And at that point, historically, seems to be around when we start to see major slowdowns in oil demand.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
If you're a consumer, I don't need to tell you that you're feeling the pain of gas prices. How much further will oil have to go? And what will this mean for the economy? Joining me on the program is Mike McGlone from Bloomberg. And Mike, let's begin with oil. On the day you and I are speaking, it's almost $120 a barrel. And they're talking about it heading even higher, $130, and I'm hearing figures of $150. What does it look like to you as you survey the oil markets?
Hello, Jim. Thanks for having me. I'm really worried about what typically happens in oil when it pumps at this high velocity is a typical dump. The last good example is 2008. It went up to 145, the highest ever. We still haven't exceeded that. And it dropped to 40. And the only previous example of a similar high velocity rally before that was 1990. I was in the trading pits then when the Iraq invaded Kuwait. And it went from $20 to $40 back to 20. And then it took, I think, about 13 years to take out that high. So to me, that's what oil is. It's typically its own worst enemy. And I suspect we're going to have a similar situation as we did in 2008. And what just happened with the average annual average price of unleaded gas in this country is around $5 a gallon. Pretty close to it. That, to me, is very similar to when it reached $4 a gallon in 2008, and then it dropped to $2 by the end of the year, with the whole risk asset space going out. So what we just recently had is the IMF slashing global GDP estimates, and I'll end with this. We have a global GDP tracker on Bloomberg that was at about 5% at the beginning of the year, and right now it's near zero. So I'm worried that what's going to come out of this is spike in energies, pressuring consumer sentiments, pressuring GDP. And what's really unique about this period is spike in energy is actually enhancing and emboldening central banks to raise rates. For instance, I think it was about 6 of them raising rates just this week alone.
You know, the thing about it, too, Mike, is central bankers can't create more oil. So the only thing they can do is kill off demand. So I'm a little bit concerned about not only the Fed raising interest rates, but the combination of rising interest rates, rising inflation, rising gas prices. As Jamie Dimon talked about, this could be hitting the economy like a hurricane.
Well, I completely agree with that. And I think if you put in, I'm calling this year the risks for this year, the great reversion, and it looks like it's early days. So let's look at, we've had a 30% correction in the NASDAQ, 20% correction in the S&P 500. And typically when they've done that in the past, rate hike expectations from the Federal Reserve would have started going down. They're not. They're still up. We still have about 200 basis points expected compared to the current one-year Fed funds rate. And that's just, I watch the Fed fund futures. So that's an indication that this is just getting started. So I view this, and look on the back of what happened, what really boosted prices was just about a year ago, a little bit more than that, we had the biggest jump in U.S. M2 money supply to near 60% in our database since 1960. And just last month, we had the first drop in that annual, in that monthly rate in about 10 years. So to me, what's happening is the best way to get deflation is when you revert extreme levels in assets. So one statistic I'll give you is crude oil. Just a couple months ago reached the most extreme above its 100-week moving average ever. Now, that's crude oil futures, started in 1983. The only similar examples, the examples I gave you, 1990, which was the Gulf War, and then 2008. And we've had similar extremes in the Bloomberg Commodity Index. And one thing that's really starting to show the major, you know, canaries in the coal shaft is, remember, lumber was the big pump last year. It's down 50% in a year. Remember copper, the Bloomberg Industrial Metals Index was up about 40% this year in Q1. Now copper's down in the year and the industrial index is starting to trickle down. So what I see is the hurricane is coming and the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates until risk assets go down much more.
And so, you know, the saying that we had last year is inflation was transitory. The big saying this year coming from the Fed is that basically soft landing. Mike, since I've been in the business, I've only seen one soft landing. That was 1994. What are the odds that we get a soft landing, or did they crash the plane?
I think it's a virtual guarantee that we get a recession. That's how you define that. I think it's a virtual guarantee we get a very sharp correction in risk assets. But unlike 2008, when the Fed and quantitative easing and the monetary and fiscal policy came in and saved that, to me, this is going to be the enduring one. This might last a long time. It's overdue. We all knew it. And what I think is going to happen here is we're going to look back and say, this is the reset we needed. What it's going to do is going to just break away all that silly greed we all saw, particularly in cryptos and massive speculation. And it's going to accelerate pre-existing trends that are very favorable, most notably for the U.S. And that is the adoption and the acceleration of decarbonization and electrification. So let's point out key facts compared to the last time we had a simple pump and dump in assets, and that was 2008. Back then, the U.S. was the world's largest net importer of energy, most notably crude oil. Now the U.S. is the world's largest energy producer, net exporter, most notably of liquefied natural gas. If you include Canada, it's a major surplus. And that's happened because of adopting technology. And we've had this issue with China pushing back on free market capitalism, with them supporting Russia in this major war. And so there's so many things going on here that from the future, we're going to look back at this as a reset we needed. But right now, it's only been a few months. And I look at this as, I'll end on this, in 2008. Now, things never rhyme exactly, but in 2008, crude oil peaked on July 3rd. And unleaded gas around the same time. And here we are June 7th, and prices look as stretched as they did back then to me. But the macroeconomic situation, I think, is worse than it was back then.
What about some of these green metals? Let's talk about copper, lithium, nickel, the things that we need to make this transition to a green economy. What's your view on them?
I'm sure glad you asked about copper, Jim. For first of all, copper's down in the year. The metal, known to have a PhD in economics, is showing here there's a problem. Lumber is down in the year. It's down 50%. There was the big jump last year on the back of housing and supply constraints. So I think what you're going to see is, in the big picture, longer term, 5-10 years, the metals, the industrial metals, most notably copper, and the metals you can invest in that are really part of that demand pull for electrification and decarbonization that are going to accelerate, will be the best performers, and they've been the best performers for most of the last 10 or 20 years. That process will resume, but right now it's more about economics, it's about China decline in this war that's spiking energy. So what's going to happen, I think, is that's going to push the market more towards recession. Crude oil has been one of the worst investments. In fact, if you look at compared to the Bloomberg Commodity Index, it's way underperformed for the last 10 or 20 years, and copper has actually outperformed until recently. I just expect it's very simple. Those pre-existing tends to resume, but the world as we know, for people like me who have electric cars and solar panels, that process is accelerating. And the key thing about copper is it has a long lead time, it's easy to store, and compared to crude oil, it's not substitutable. I mean, I'm from the farm belt. I used to have a farm, and 13% of our unleaded gas in this country comes from ethanol. It's being substituted rapidly. We're reducing demand for fossil fuels, increasing supply with technology. But all that technology is increasing demand for things like copper and silver and aluminum and cobalt and nickel.
Let's move to another commodity, and that's gold. I'm really surprised given the inflation levels. You know, we hit a nice peak in March. But, you know, we've sort of been trading sideways between the 1850, 1950, and that $100 range. What's your take on gold here?
And your time is impactful. We're speaking on Tuesday the 7th. I'll be publishing tomorrow morning now how gold has been the commodity stud for at least 20 years. It's outperformed virtually most of the Bloomberg Commodity Index, clearly outperformed crude oil. But this is one of the rare situations ever when the whole commodity index has reached the most ever in about 20 years versus a 200-week, 100-week moving average. And gold is actually hovering at its 100-week moving average for almost a year now. So I look at gold as it's about as trend-ready as it's going to get. And I think it's going to be one of the top performers starting in Q2 and 2H, partly because it basically is predicated on we need a bit of a peak in crude oil and energy, but gold is to me where the foundation is. The key thing is now technically it looks good. Fundamentally, it's good because I think we're going to have a more of a deflationary period coming forward. And where does deflation come from? When risk assets go up too far and just come back. But the key thing about it is what I mentioned earlier is rapidly advancing technology, i.e. Bitcoin is part of the competition for gold, as is biofuels, and technology is for energy. So what I see is gold is going to be one of the best performers, but I look at gold as somewhat naked, if not paired with Bitcoin. The thing about Bitcoin is it was one of the best performers of the last decade. It's coming back, but at some point it's going to transition. So I'm very bullish gold, particularly as the vision I see is going to be more of a 2008 type scenario where we go back, we push back, and we go back to a deflationary period. The Fed's going to succeed. I guarantee that. And every central bank in the world, because they'll keep raising rates until risk assets decline, and gold should come out better.
And related to gold, what about silver?
Problem. I'm worried about silver because it's more associated with copper. Big picture, very bullish silver, as I am copper and nickel and aluminum and zinc and most industrial metals. But right now, copper is more of an industrial metal. It used to be precious. been transitioning away from precious for decades, most nonetheless, I should say centuries, most nonetheless decade, but it is more now, demand for silver is more more industrial than it is precious, and it is one of the key laggards on the year. So I see silver right now down about 5% in the year, partly because copper starting to get hit. But in the big picture, it's that industrialization, the decarbonization, electrification trends will really support silver. It's just going to be a little while. But then when the key thing to remember about silver is when gold performs, it's usually basically considered leveraged gold. And it's just going to be a little while.
And let's move on to something as we talk about this green economy. That's uranium. I mean, you know, you drive electric car. If we're going to move in that area, especially in California, you pull at a stoplight and almost every other car is a Tesla. So, I mean, where are we going to get the electricity to power all those cars at night?
Well, exactly. And the key thing to remember there is about uranium, it's not really an investable commodity. You can invest in directly and you have to go to the producers. And that's the key thing I've been pointing out since the beginning of this year when the war became clear that this is an absolute boom for North American commodity producers, agriculture, energy, metals. Uranium's a little different story because it's harder to, you know, how do you identify those producers? I'll let you figure that out. But I look at it as, and I drive a poor man's Tesla. I drive a Chevy Volt with a V. But that trend is clearly continuing. But the key thing to remember about electricity production is the cost of that has, although it's jumped recently, but it's declining rapidly relative to most other assets because of rapidly advancing technology, i.e. solar panels, renewable sources. It's the storage is the key link. And this is not my views. It's just basically the things I got from the books like The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth. Unless we expect technology to go backwards, yes, we need uranium, but natural gas is still there. But I view decentralized solar as one of the best sources of electricity. It's really kicking in Hawaii. I don't know about wind so much, but that's just a matter of time once we get the storage down. I'm looking at a 5-10 year basis, and it's just hard to push back on this technology. Electric cars are wonderful. Once you drive one, you realize how great they are. So that's the way I see it. And it's also the views I've read from things like in The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth.
Let's talk about, as an investor, given what you see right now, we expect oil prices to probably spike higher before they come down. Copper is pulling back with the weakness in the economy. What would you be doing as an investor here?
I have to be careful about giving investment advice, but I think the best thing is I honestly think the next big move in crude oil is absolute flush like 2008. Up on the escalator, down in the elevator. It just needs that inflection point. I don't know when it's going to kick in, but at some point we should wake up and crude oil be down 10, 20, 30% in a week. It's just the way it usually works. But of course, that might be a global recession. So I like to point out, I think some of the best performing assets will be gold, U.S. long bonds, and Bitcoin eventually. Now, Bitcoin's still risk on, but I think it's transitioning to risk off. I think gold is going to break out. And I see U.S. long bonds, treasury bonds around 3%, 313 in the long bond, 3% in the 10-year is potentially the best potential because that's not profound. It's just I think we're going to resume those deflationary trends we had before COVID as we had this big spike in risk assets, goes down harder and kicks into a deflationary environment, which is what we were before. So to me, if there's any time to be underweight equities for maybe a 5 to 10 year period, we just had one of the best rallies in I don't know how long from a lot of people like Jerry Grantham say. I think that's just the key thing. Look, and there's nothing wrong with cash, too. I'm just pointing out facts of what's happened in the past when you get this extended. And, of course, we've never had a situation where we had money supply jump 26% in 1 year and fiscal monetary stimulus at the same time.
Well, great stuff, Mike. If our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Oh, I appreciate you asking. I'm on LinkedIn. Happy to link in. Happy to put people on my distribution list, Mike McGlone on Bloomberg. And I'm on Twitter, Mike McGlone 11. I don't respond as much on Twitter, but I do post a lot of my stuff there.
All right. Great to have you on the program. All the best to you. Have a great summer.
Jim, let's start off with the energy crisis topic. Obviously, this is front and center mind for most people listening right now. In early 2020, specifically March of 2020, you had written a series of articles talking about a long-term persistent inflationary outlook. You also discussed a brewing energy crisis underway as we move from massive surplus and a shutdown in production, which would set us up for an eventual energy crisis. And obviously, that's where we are today.
I think it was March of 2020 where we actually had a negative print in the futures market on oil prices. Actually, traders were paying people to offload their contracts. But the big thing that I've been watching, Chris, I've always been a believer in peak oil. I think we've just postponed it. But one of the things that really hit me, and this began in 2014, where Saudi Arabia was concerned about U.S. shale producers because shale production in the United States was rising at a fast pace. I mean, we went from producing 5 million barrels eventually to the peak at 13. But what happened during that period of time, Saudi Arabia had a price war. They were going to drive the price of oil down, and it was their thinking that they would put our producers out of business. Well, it backfired, and in the process, what they did is drove oil prices from triple digits down into the low 50s and 60s. Well, it backfired. It didn't work. American shale producers became more productive with technology. They brought down the cost of producing shale oil. But one thing that did trigger, with the price of oil dropping from, let's say, 110 down into the 50 and 60, what happened, oil companies began to cut back on their investments in tremendously. In fact, the amount of money that they were spending was cut by almost 50%. Well, if you look at whether you're drilling for shale or you're drilling for, let's say, offshore oil, it's very expensive. And if you can't justify the price to make the investment, then what you do is you pull back on investments. Well, what does that mean? It means that you are producing less, you're not replacing what you're producing, so eventually the price of oil was going to catch up. So fundamentally, number one, was that there was a lack of investment. Number two, and we've talked about this on the show in the past, is ESG. So you have a lot of Wall Street firms, a lot of banks that do not want to finance the energy sector. So basically, if we take a look at prices now, the energy sector has been demonized, especially with the Biden administration. So if you're being demonized, I mean, what's the incentive to go out and make those additional investments? You also had Wall Street investment banks that just simply did not want to finance a lot of these smaller companies. Now, if you're Exxon, Chevron, you don't have a problem tapping the bond markets and getting financing. But if you're a smaller shale producer, it is very difficult to find money to finance. And one of the things about shale that makes it so much different than other, let's say, conventional oil, is shale wells run out within about a two-year period. So you get a fast payback. But here's the problem with shale. You have to constantly be drilling new wells because the well you drilled 2 years ago is run dry, so you have to poke another hole in the ground. Well, what does that take? It takes financing. And if you can't get the financing, then you aren't drilling, which means you're not producing. So that was a factor. And then we have the war on energy with the Biden administration. I mean, the president, the first day in office, canceled the Keystone Pipeline. You know, had he allowed that to go through, we'd be getting several million barrels of Canadian oil into this country. The other thing is it's more expensive to transport oil by train, and it's much more environmentally hazardous than through a pipeline. So that added about another $8 to the cost of fuel. And even today, they're not backing down. So they want to get to this green economy, and they think by mandate in 10 years, we're going to transition from fossil fuels to a green economy. It's not simply not going to happen. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the grid. And if we're shutting down nuclear plants, coal plants, and other plants, what's going to provide that electricity? So all the fundamentals, Chris, were arguing for higher prices. And then another, I would throw two other factors. If you take a look at the major oil companies, Western oil companies, they're only replacing about 86% of their production. So their reserves are not keeping up to replace what they're producing. So that is a factor. And then you also have this idea that the world has that Saudi Arabia has this spare capacity that they could take it up by another 2.5 million barrels. In other words, they could go from 10 million barrels a day to 12 and a half. I can tell you that's never going to happen. They had difficulty even staying up at 10 million barrels. And when they did, they were really repricing Iraqi oil as their own, or they were shipping it out of inventory. Because a real key factor here is what we call the giant oil fields. There's about 500 of them, and they account for most of the oil that we consume. The problem is many of these oil fields, like Garwar or Canarel, which in Mexico was the second largest field that ran dry, is they artificially increased their reserves in 1988. OPEC came together and said, you are allowed to produce, your production rate is based on your reserves. So Chris, magically in 1 year, the reserves of Saudi Arabia, of Kuwait, all these companies doubled their reserves without any major discoveries. The other factor is if you look at, for example, the BP Statistical Review, they show Saudi Arabia's reserves at 260 billion barrels. They've been that way for 30 years, despite the fact that they're producing about 3% of their reserves. So as Matt Simmons wrote in Twilight in the Desert in 2005, I don't think those reserves are there. So in summary, Chris, we saw the fundamentals, we saw the economy improving. Another issue we'll get into later on, China's economy coming back online, what that might mean for energy demand. But it was fundamentals and the political aspects of it. And of course, now we can throw in the Ukraine war and Russian oil. And of course, I didn't see the Ukraine war coming, but I saw the fundamentals and also the political aspects of oil, which told me oil prices were going to head higher.
Chris, let me add to what Jim just said. I've been following the work of Goldman Sachs head commodity strategist Jeff Currie, and he's been really pounding the table on the risks to higher commodity prices given the lack of investment, everything that Jim just said. And he basically called it the revenge of the old economy. And, you know, after listening to an interview and reading some reports that he did, you know, Jim mentioned BP Statistical Review of World Energy is a treasure trove of, you know, amazing information. And a lot of this is uploaded to Bloomberg. So I ran a bunch of basically looking at production and consumption of various commodities. And I normalized it since 2007 to kind of see, you know, at the prior peak in energy, which was really 2008, but I went from 2007 on, I wanted to see what the energy policies were for major countries around the world. And to give you an idea, and again, this is all data based on BP Statistical Review of World Energy. So since 2007, the U.S. has cut its coal production by 55%. Germany has cut its coal production by 56%, and the UK has cut their coal production by 90%. So they've really kind of shifted towards clean energy, particularly abroad. But it's not just, you know, dirty fuels like coal, it's even clean energy fuels like nuclear. So for example, using again the BP Statistical Review, I ran the data since 2011, which was the Japanese Fukushima nuclear meltdown. And since that time, Japan has cut its nuclear energy consumption by 82%. Germany has cut their nuclear consumption by 46%, while nuclear consumption here in the U.S. and the U.K. has been mostly muted since the disaster. However, China has increased their nuclear consumption by 298% as part of their concerted effort to shift away from coal and reduce their air pollution. In terms of natural gas, again, I'm looking back to 2007, natural gas being a cleaner fuel, China has grown its natural gas production by 229%. The U.S. has grown our production by 82%, while Germany has cut its natural gas production by 73%, and the U.K. by 53%. So you can see massive cuts in terms of energy production in most regions, except for natural gas in the U.S., but other regions have seen a significant reduction in coal, natural gas, and nuclear. And one of the arguments I was making last year was given these dramatic cuts in production of fossil fuels, that Europe and the U.K. were leaving themselves at the mercy of Russia and the U.S. to help meet their needs. Obviously, you know, that wasn't predicting any invasion by Russia, but still, it did show the precarious nature that the UK and Europe were leaving themselves by dramatically cutting the production of their fossil fuels, making them reliant on potentially unfriendly neighbors. So it was this real reduction in overall production. While going green, the production increase in green energy has not been enough to replace the traditional fossil fuel production of energy.
And one of the other things I'd probably add on top of that, Chris, and this is something we covered with John Roque in today's broadcast, and that is we're shutting down coal plants and we're going with wind and solar. The problem with wind and solar, it's intermittent, number one. And number two, it doesn't work everywhere. If you've got cloud cover in Seattle, obviously solar doesn't do you much good. Or if you're somewhere in the country where the wind doesn't blow, what are you going to do? The other aspect to even EVs is the EVs don't work as well in colder climates. And so we're trying to make this transition by mandates that are coming from politicians that aren't clearly thinking through the outcome. Okay, if we're going to go to EVs, what about charging stations? Where are we going to get the electricity? And one of the things that you need is reliable electricity. And unfortunately, solar and wind are not reliable. You know, one thing we know, we get darkness at night. Solar doesn't work in darkness. In other places, we don't get wind. And so that's why I think we're making a lot of mistakes by not emphasizing nuclear. There's 52 nuclear power plants built around the globe. The U.S. is building two while we're shutting down six. So we're going to have a net deficit at a time where we're going to be dependent on more reliable sources of electricity.
And this leads right into this idea that, you know, the cheapest source of inputs that we can use for energy is fossil fuels. And we've obviously made use of that over the decades prior. Cheap fossil fuels and that cheap source of energy has allowed for the industrialization of not just the U.S. economy, but the global economy as a whole. And now we're trying to move away from that, which leads to higher inflation. And again, starting in 2020, the two big calls that we were making on our podcast and our website were that we're looking at planting the seeds for an energy crisis and for up to a decade of higher than average inflation. Obviously, this has been a theme that we've been reiterating ever since 2020. So tell us about how this works into the outlook for higher inflation, and especially how this corresponds to the market outlook that we foresee over the next decade or more.
Well, two of the things that really struck me, and it was one of the reasons why I talked about inflation back in March of 2020, and what we were doing essentially in terms of managing the pandemic, we were shutting down businesses, services, so we were shutting down supply. And at the same time, we were shoveling literally trillions and trillions of dollars into people's pocketbooks. In other words, we were doing helicopter drops. You were getting deposits into your bank account from the Treasury. So, you know, what is it? One of the classic definitions of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. So the government was giving you money to go spend. At the same time, they were shutting down the supply. The other aspect that came to the fore during that period of time is we realized how dependent we are on China for producing goods. So as China shut down its economy, we started to have more supply chain issues. So the combination of that, and then, Chris, it hasn't even stopped this year or last year. The first thing the Biden administration did was pass a bill of $1.9 trillion in spending. And the thing that really concerns me and why I think this is going to continue, and the best example I can give you is Janet Yellen's testimony before Congress this week. So instead of talking about inflation and bringing it down, she talked about abortion, gun control, and climate change, things that she's not qualified to talk about. And when they asked her about inflation, she says, well, we're hopeful that it'll come down. Well, you're head of Treasury. You were a former Fed head of the Fed. You need something more than hopeful. And she advocated actually more spending particular, the Build Back Better bill, which would be $5 trillion of spending. So obviously, those in Washington don't understand what causes inflation. And this is part of this MMT, modern monetary theory, where if you issue debt in your own currency, you don't have to worry about it. And that permeates much of Washington, including both political parties, including the White House.
Chris, can you give us some color in terms of the long-term inflationary outlook based on the data that you're looking at?
Well, for me, one of the things that, you know, I've been looking at, which would be very different, you know, it's never a good thing to say this time it's different, because rarely it is. Those are, you know, some of the most dangerous words you can utter in terms of investing. However, coming out of 2020 was unlike anything we've ever seen before. Typically, what you end up happening is after a prolonged period of expansion, you see commodity producers seeing the higher prices in commodities, which typically have their greatest run near the end of an expansion, given the record profits, and then take some of that and then they increase production and their capacity. And they often do it at the end of the cycle so that just as the economy is slipping into recession, you actually have a surge in supply coming to the market, meeting a market which is seeing a weakening in demand. And so the consequence of most recessions here in the U.S. is that we see demand collapse and supply is slow to respond. Therefore, we see a huge surge in inventories. So therefore, when you look at the inflation cycle and you look at even the interest rate cycle, in the early part of an expansion, inflation is not a concern and interest rates are typically very slow to start rising. And that has to do with commodities, which are very slow to rise. Inflation is something you worry about near the end of a cycle, not the beginning. This was completely upended in terms of our COVID response. So with everyone remaining home, we did not see a collapse in demand. We did for services, because obviously we couldn't spend on services, but we saw a surge in demand for goods. And we saw record purchases of goods. Now, at the same time, we had this greater demand for goods, it was met with a decrease in supply because workers weren't able to go to manufacturing plants, miners weren't able to go to the mines to produce more commodities. So we had a shortage in production of goods. At the same time, we had an increase in demand. And so coming out of the COVID-induced recession, not just here in the U.S., but globally, we were faced with record low inventories of commodities. They did not rise. And so this is why we felt that commodity inflation would be persistent and pronounced for a prolonged period, not a temporary bout of it, and that the commodity inflation would occur early in this expansion. And that's exactly what we've seen. And even now, you know, literally 2 years beyond the onset of COVID in the lockdowns, we still are faced with record low inventories of base metals. Agricultural inventories are low. Energy inventories are low. For example, on the East Coast is seeing 30-year lows in distillate inventories. We have major shortages of commodities. And so that's why I feel that inflation will be sticky. I do think it's going to moderate just from a year-over-year base comparison effect. But I do expect it to remain sticky due to housing inflation and persistent commodity inflation.
And Chris, let me add one more element to that and why we think inflation is going to remain high. Everybody's focused right now on gasoline prices because that's something we see every single day. You fill up your tank, you're seeing prices rise almost weekly. People have no idea what oil means for our economy. There's an article out there. There's 6,000 items that are made from petroleum. Everything from tubing, TV cabinets, tents, tires, aspirin, vitamin capsules, wind turbine blades, electric blankets. I could go on and on and on, but everything you have in your household has some derivative form that it came from petroleum. You know, everything from shampoo, pharmaceuticals, washers. I mean, I could literally talk for another 15 minutes of the items that are made that come from petroleum. So it's not just gas at the pump. It's a lot of things that we buy on a day-to-day use in our everyday living.
So I think the big question is when we look at, we're in an age of shortages, inventory levels across the commodity space, the natural resource space at large, energy, agriculture commodities, industrial commodities. I mean, they're at multi-year, if not multi-decade lows in many cases. So the longer-term outlook is for higher than average inflation. This is something that we've been, again, reiterating over and over and over on why investors need to gain and increase their exposure to commodities if they aren't already, as a hedge for inflation. The big question now is, we've seen prices run up so far so fast, especially with oil prices. At what point now do we reach the pain point and that tip us into recession? So soft landing versus hard landing. What are your thoughts on that to either of you?
You know, the thing that strikes me is we have, you know, if you take a look at all the recessions in the past, they've had three variables tied to them: inflation, rising oil prices, rising interest rates. This is one of the first times I've seen the Fed begin a rate raising cycle when the economy was in a process of rolling over and slowing down. But now we have oil prices that are rising. I expect that we could see close to 150, if not more. And, you know, there's nothing the Fed can do on oil. The only thing they can do is kill demand. So I find it real hard to find rising interest rates and rising oil prices, which is really a tax on consumers. It's interesting to see last year consumers added $1 trillion worth of debt. So they were spending, but they were taking on more debt to do so. And now we've stopped some of these transfer payment checks. So where are they going to get the money for that? We're seeing them change preferences. Grocery stores are reporting that consumers are now going more to generic brands rather than name brands to save money. So everywhere we look, people are trying to save money. And I just don't know, Chris, how with rising rates, which are raising mortgage rates, it's more expensive to buy a home. It's more expensive to finance anything today, how that is not going to have an impact. I don't have a lot of confidence that they can engineer a soft landing, especially with the amount of debt. And especially when we take a look at the commodity cycle right now, where we have such low inventories of natural gas and diesel fuel and other things that we use oil for, whether it's jet fuel, gasoline, diesel, and other things. I just, for the life of me, I just don't see a soft landing.
That concludes the first half of our conversation covering energy, inflation, and why we are preparing for a hard landing ahead. In the second half, posting next week, we are going to talk about what is now happening under the surface in the credit markets, and particularly when it comes to liquidity, which is also making the case for, at best, more market volatility, but most likely continued problems for the overall stock market. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.